Chapter 2. Uniformly, monotonously, the days follow each other. In the morning, 4 hours teaching. In the afternoon, 2. But between, all the hours of sitting about, running around, alone with oneself and one's thoughts. Sundays are worst of all. When one does not want merely to sit in the pub, it is simply unbearable. The headmaster, the only other male teacher besides myself, has been here 30 years and has made use of his time to become an expert breeder of pigs. He has won many prizes. But beyond that, there is nothing one can talk to him about. When I look at him, I want to clear out at once, so dreadful is the thought that someday I shall be like him. There is one woman teacher as well, a worthy middle-aged creature, but she would have a fit if one were to say, damn and blast. Also not exactly inspiriting. Villy had settled in much better. He goes as an official personage to all the weddings and christenings. When the horses get colic or the cows won't calve, he helps the farmers with his advice and support. And in the evenings, he will sit with them in the taverns and fleece them at Scott. I have no wish now to lounge in the pubs. I prefer to stay in my room. But the hours are long, and strange thoughts often creep out of the corners. Pale, wasted hands, beckoning, threatening. Ghostly shadows of things past, but strangely changed. Memories that rise up again of gray, sightless faces, cries and accusations. One dismal Sunday morning, I get up early, put on my things, and go to the station to visit Adolf Bethke. This is a good idea, for so I shall sit again with a human being really dear to me, and by the time I get back, the dreary Sunday will be over. I arrive there in the afternoon. The gate creaks, and the dog in his kennel begins to bark. I walk quickly down the path between the fruit trees. Adolf is at home. His wife is there too, but as I enter and shake hands with Adolf, she leaves the room. I sit down. We talk, and after a while, Adolf says, "You're surprised, I suppose, Ernst, eh?" "Now, how do you mean, Adolf?" "Finding her back again." "No, seems to me that's your affair, Adolf." He pushes a dish of fruit toward me. "Have an apple?" I take one and offer him a cigar. He bites off the end and goes on, "Well, it was this way, Ernst. I sat and sat here, and pretty soon I began to go crazy. When you're alone as I was alone, a house is an awful place. You go around the room, there is one of her blouses still hanging. Those are her sewing things. That's the chair she used to sit in and sew. And then at night, the other bed, so white and deserted beside you. You look across there every few minutes. You toss and turn over and over. You can't get to sleep. All kinds of things begin to go through your head, Ernst." "I can well believe it, Adolf." "And then at last you clear out and get tight and do something silly." I nod. The clock is ticking. The stove crackles. His wife comes in quietly, puts bread and butter on the table and goes away again. Bethke smooths his hand over the tablecloth. "Yes, Ernst, and that's how it was here for her, too. She had to sit about here just like that, all those years. She would lie there in fear and uncertainty. She brooded and listened. Then at last it came. She didn't want it at first, no doubt. But then, when once it was there, well, she didn't know how to help herself anymore. And so, one thing led on to another." His wife enters, bringing coffee. I would like to say good day to her, but she does not look at me. "Won't you bring a cup for yourself, too?" asks Adolf.
"There is something I must do in the kitchen," she says. She has a soft, deep voice.
"I sat here," resumes Adolf, "and said to myself, well, you've fired her out, you've vindicated your honor. Then I would think, And what comfort does your honor bring you? You know it's only a tag. You're alone. And honor or no honor, it doesn't make that any better. So I told her she could come back. What the hell does it all matter anyway? A man is tired and will only live a few years. If he'd never known, things would have gone on as before. And who can say what would happen if one always knew everything?
Adolf plays nervously with his fingers on the arm of his chair.
Have some coffee, Ernst. And there's butter, too.
I fill the cups and we drink.
You see, Ernst, he says gently, it's so much easier for you. You've your books and your education and all the rest of it. But I have nothing else. Only my wife.
I say nothing to that. I could not explain it to him. He is no longer the man he was at the front. Nor am I. And what does she say about it? I ask after a pause. Adolf lets his hands drop.
She says very little, and one can't get much out of her either. She just sits there and looks at you. At most, she only cries. She hardly ever speaks.
He pushes his cup aside.
Once she said it was just to have somebody here. And then again, she says she did not realize, she didn't know she was doing me any harm by it. It was as if I were there. But one can't believe that. Surely it must be possible to discriminate in things of that sort. She's quite all right otherwise.
I think a while.
Perhaps she means she wasn't quite sure what she was doing at the time. As if she dreamed it, you know?
One does dream queer things sometimes, Adolf.
Maybe, he replies.
But I don't understand it. It certainly did not go on for long.
And she doesn't want to have anything more to do with the other fellow, I ask.
She belongs here. That's what she says.
I think over it a while. What else should one ask?
And are things any better with you now, Adolf?
He looks at me.
Not much, Ernst. But then that's not to be wondered at. Not as yet.
That will all come in time. Don't you think so, too?
He doesn't look as if he quite believes it himself.
Sure, it'll all come right again someday,
I say, and put a few more cigars on the table. We continued to talk a while. Then I go. In the passage, I encounter his wife, who makes to pass by me hastily.
Goodbye, Frau Bethke,
I say, offering to shake hands.
Goodbye,
she answers, turning her face away as she gives me her hand.
Adolf comes with me to the station.
The wind is blustering. I steal sidelong glances at him as we walk, and remember how he would smile wistfully to himself whenever we would speak of peace out in the trenches there. Now what has come of it all? The train starts.
Adolf,
I say quickly from the window.
I understand you all right. You don't know how well I do understand.
He is going back alone over the fields to his house. The bell sounds for the 10 o'clock play interval. I have just given an hour's lesson to the upper form. The 14-year-olds are now charging past me out into the open. I watch them from the window. Within a few seconds, they have altered completely. They have stripped off the discipline of the schoolroom and put on again the freshness and untamedness of their youth. Seated here on their forms in front of me, they are not true to themselves. There is something either of sneaks and suckers about them, or of shammers and rebels. 7 years of teaching it has needed to bring them to this. Unspoiled by education, frank and unsuspecting as young animals, they came up to school from their meadows, their games, and their dreams. The simple law of life was alone valid for them. The most vital, the most forceful among them was leader. The rest followed him. But little by little, with the weekly portions of tuition, another artificial set of values was foisted upon them. He who knew his lesson best was termed excellent and ranked foremost, and the rest must emulate him. Little wonder, indeed, if the more vital of them resist it. But they have to knuckle under, for the ideal of the school is the good scholar. But what an ideal! Whatever came of the good scholars in the world? In the hothouse of the school they do enjoy a short semblance of life, but only the more surely to sink back afterward into mediocrity and insignificance. The world has been bettered only by the bad scholars. I watch them at their games. With vigorous, supple movements, they are led on by the curly-headed Domholt, ruling the whole playground with his energy. His eyes are flashing with courage and eagerness for the assault. All his muscles, his sinews tense, his glance keen, and the rest follow him unhesitatingly. Yet in 10 minutes' time, when he is sitting here on the form again, from this same boy will emerge an obdurate, pig-headed little devil who never can do his tasks, and who will surely be left behind again at the next Easter promotions. He will put on a pious face when I look at him, and as soon as my back is turned, he will be making grimaces. He will lie like a knave when I ask him if he did his own homework, and if he gets half a chance, he will spit on my breeches or put a drawing pin on my chair. But the top boy, who now cuts such a sorry figure out there on the playground, will swell visibly here in the classroom. Full of conceit and knowledgeableness, he will shoot up his hand at every question, while Domholt sits there and knows nothing, hopeless and furious, awaiting his plucking. The top boy knows everything, and even knows that. Yet Domholt, whom I really should punish, is 1,000 times more to my liking than this pale-faced model boy. I shrug my shoulders. Haven't I seen something like it before? At that regimental reunion at Konersmann's. There also did not the man suddenly count for nothing and his occupation for everything, though before that, out at the front, it had been the other way. I shake my head. What a world to come back to. Domholt's voice goes yelling through the playground. I wonder to myself whether a more comradely attitude on the part of the teacher toward the pupil might not help matters. It might possibly improve the relationship a little and get over a few of the difficulties. But at bottom, it would merely be an illusion. Youth is sharp-sighted and incorruptible. It hands together and presents an impenetrable front against the grown-ups. It is not sentimental. One may approach to it, but one cannot enter into it. Who has once been evicted from that paradise can never get back. There is a law of the years. Domholt, with his sharp eyes, would cold-bloodedly turn any such camaraderie to his own advantage. He might show even a certain affection, yet that would not prevent him looking to his own interest. Educationalists who think they can understand the young are enthusiasts. Youth does not want to be understood. It wants only to be let alone. It preserves itself immune against the insidious bacillus of being understood. The grown-up who would approach it too importunately is as ridiculous in its eyes as if he had put on children's clothes. We may feel with youth, but youth does not feel with us. That is its salvation. The bell rings. The interval is over. Reluctantly, Domholt falls into the line before the door. I stroll out through the village on my way to the moors. Wolf is running ahead of me. A bulldog suddenly rushes out from a neighboring farmyard and goes for him. Wolf has not seen it, so that in the first onset the dog manages to get him down. The next instant all is lost in a wild melee of dust, thrashing bodies, and fearsome growls. The farmer, armed with a cudgel, comes running out of the house.
"For God's sake, teacher,"
he shouts out of the distance. Call your dog off! Pluto will tear him to pieces! I take no notice. Pluto! Pluto! You butcher, damn you! Come here! He yells excitedly and dashes up, all out of breath, to beat them apart. But the whirlwind now sweeps off with wild yelpings for another 100 yards, and there the coil begins again. He's lost, gasps the farmer, lowering his cudgel. But I tell you right now, I don't pay a farthing. You ought to have called him off. Who is lost? I ask. Your dog, returns the farmer respectfully. That rapscallion of a bulldog is already made cold meat of a dozen of them now. Well, I don't think we need worry about Wolf, I say. That's no ordinary sheepdog, I tell you, old dimer. He's a war dog and old soldier, you know. The dust clears. The dogs have shifted to a grassy patch. I see the bulldog trying to drag Wolf down so as to get his teeth into the nape of his neck. If he succeeds, Wolf is certainly lost, for then it will be a simple matter for the bulldog to break his neck. But now, like an eel, the sheepdog glides swiftly over the ground, clears the fangs by half an inch, whips round and immediately attacks again. The bulldog is growling and yelping, but Wolf fights without a sound. Damn! Exclaims the farmer. The bulldog shakes itself, makes a spring, but snaps the empty air. It turns again, furiously, springs again, and again shoots by, wide of the mark. One might almost think he was alone, so little is the sheepdog visible. Wolf flies like a cat close over the ground. He learned that as a messenger dog. He slips between the bulldog's legs and goes for it from below. He encircles it, spins round, then suddenly has his teeth into its belly and holds fast. The bulldog howls like mad and throws itself on the ground to get him that way. But quick as lightning, with a sudden jerk, Wolf lets go and takes his chance to go for its throat. Now I hear him growl for the first time, muffled and dangerous. Now he has his opponent and holds fast, indifferent to the way the bulldog struggles and rolls about on the ground. For God's sake, teacher, shouts the farmer. Call your dog off. He will tear Pluto to pieces. I might call till the cows came home, but he wouldn't listen now, I tell him. And a good thing, too. It's high time your bloody Pluto was shown something. The bulldog yelps and howls. The farmer raises his cudgel to go to his help. I wrench the thing from him, seize him by the front of his jacket, and shout angrily, What the hell? Your bloody mongrel started it! It would not need much, and I should be going for the farmer myself. But I see from where I stand that Wolf has suddenly let go the bulldog and is rushing toward us, imagining that I am being attacked. So I am luckily able to intercept him, otherwise the farmer would soon be needing a new coat, to say the least of it. Pluto, in the meantime, has made off. I pat Wolf on the neck and soothe him down. He's a devil, no mistake, stammers the farmer, quite crestfallen. You're right, he is, I say with pride. That's the old soldier in him. Doesn't do to make trouble with that breed. We go on our way. Beyond the village are a few meadows. Then begins the moor with its junipers and ancient burial grounds. Near the birch wood a flock of sheep is grazing, and their woolly backs glow golden under the light of the descending sun. Suddenly I see Wolf make off at full tilt toward the flock. I suppose that the fight with the bulldog has made him wild, and dash after him to prevent a massacre among the sheep. Hey, look out for the dog, I shout loudly to the shepherd. He laughs. He's only a sheep dog. He won't do anything. Won't he, though? I shout back. You don't know him.
He's a war dog. What's it matter? Says the shepherd. War dog or no war dog, he's all right. There, see? Just look at him. Good, good dog. Go for him. Fetch him in.
I can hardly believe my eyes. Wolf, Wolf, who has never seen a sheep in his life before, is now driving the flock as if he had never done anything else. With long bounds, he sweeps off, barking after two straggling lambs, and drives them back. Every time they want to stand still or to go off at a tangent, he bars their way and snaps at their heels so that they run on again straight ahead.
Tip top, says the shepherd. He's only nipping them. Couldn't be better.
The dog seems transfigured. His eyes sparkle. His tattered ear flaps as he circles watchfully around the flock, and I can see he is immensely excited.
I'll buy him from you right now, says the shepherd. My own can't do it better than that. Just look now how he's heading them home to the village. He hasn't a thing to learn.
I am quite beside myself.
Wolf, I cry. Wolf,
and could shout for joy to see him. He grew up out there among the shells, and yet now, without anyone ever having shown him a thing, he knows what his job is.
I'll give you £5 down for him, and a sheep ready killed into the bargain, says the shepherd.
I shake my head.
You couldn't have him for a million, man, I retort.
Now it is the shepherd who is shaking his head. The harsh spikes of the heather tickle my face. I bend them aside and rest my head on my arm. The dog is breathing quietly beside me, and out of the distance sounds faintly the tinkle of sheep bells. Otherwise, all is still. Clouds float slowly over the evening sky. The sun goes down. The dark green of the juniper bushes turns to a deep brown, and I perceive the night wind rise up lightly out of the distant woods. Within the hour it will be playing among the birches. Soldiers are as familiar with the country as farmers and foresters. They have not lived in rooms. They know the times of the wind and the yellow-brown cinnamon haze of the gathering evening. They know the shadows that ride over the ground when the clouds hide the sun and the ways of the moon. Once in Flanders, after a fierce bombardment, it was long before help could come up for one of our men who had been wounded. We put all our field dressings on him and bandaged him up as best we could, but it was no use. He still bled on, just bled away to death. And behind him all the while stood an immense cloud in the evening sky, a solitary cloud, but it was a great mountain of white, golden, and red splendor. Unsubstantial and lofty, it towered up over the shattered brown of the landscape. It was quite still, and it glowed, and the dying man was quite still, and he bled, as if the two belonged together. And yet to me, it was incomprehensible that the cloud should stand there so lovely and unconcerned in the sky while a man died. The last light of the sun has tinged the heather to a dusky red. Plovers rise, complaining on unstable wing. The cry of a bittern sounds up from the lake. I still gaze out over the wide, purple-brown plain. There was a place near Utule where so many poppies grew in the fields that they were entirely red because of them. We called them the Fields of Blood, because whenever there was a thunderstorm, they would take on the pale color of fresh, newly spilled blood. It was there Kohler went mad one clear night as we marched by, utterly wasted and weary. In the uncertain light of the moon, he thought he saw whole lakes of blood and wanted to plunge in. I shiver and look up. But what does it mean? Why do these memories come so often now? And so strangely and so differently from out there at the front. Am I too much alone? Wolf stirs and barks quite loudly, though gently, in his sleep. Is he dreaming of his flock, I wonder? I look at him a long time. Then I wake him, and we go back. It is Saturday. I go over to Villy and ask him if he will come into town with me over Sunday, but he dismisses the idea altogether.
"We're having stuffed goose tomorrow," says he. "I can't possibly leave that in the lurch. What do you want to go away for?"
"I can't stick Sundays here," I say.
"I don't understand that," he objects.
"Not considering the grub." So I set off alone. In the evening, vaguely hoping for something, I go out to Waldmann's. Here is immense activity. I stand about and look on for a while. A mob of young fellows who missed the war by a hair is swirling about on the dance floor. These are sure of themselves. They know what they want. Their world has had a clear beginning. It has a definite goal. Success. And though younger than we, they are much more accomplished. I discover among the dancers the dainty little seamstress with whom I won the prize for the one step. I ask her to dance, and after that we remain together. I had my pay only a few days ago, and on the strength of it I now order a couple of bottles of a sweet red wine. We drink it slowly, but the more I drink, the more I sink into a strange moodiness. What was it Albert said about having somebody all to oneself? I listen pensively to the chatter of the girl as she twitters like a swallow of the other seamstresses about the pay for making underclothing, about new dances and a thousand other nothings. If only the pay would go up by a couple of pence apiece, she would be able to lunch in a restaurant, and then she would be happy. I envy her simple existence, and ask her more and more questions. I should like to ask every one who is here, so laughing and gay, how he lives. Perhaps among them is one who could tell me something that would help me. Afterwards, I go home with the swallow. She lives in a gray block of tenements, high up under the roof. We stand a while at the door. I feel the warmth of her hand in mine. Her face glimmers uncertain in the darkness. A human face, a hand wherein is warmth and life.
"Let me go with you," I say hastily. "Let me come in."
Cautiously, we steal up the creaking stairs. I strike a match, but she blows it out immediately, and, taking me by the hand, leads me after her. A little narrow room, a table, a brown sofa, a bed, a few pictures on the wall. In the corner, a sewing machine, a lay figure of bamboo, and a basket of white linen to be sewn. The little girl promptly produces a primus and brews tea of apple peelings and tea leaves that have been 10 times boiled and dried out again. 2 cups, a laughing, slightly mischievous face, a disturbing little blue dress, the friendly poverty of lodgings, and a little swallow, its youth, its only possession. I sit down on the sofa. Is this how love begins? So light and playfully. Is that all it needs, just to jump over oneself and away? The little swallow is fond. It belongs, of course, to her life that someone should come here, take her in his arms, and then go away again. Then the sewing machine hums. Another comes. The swallow laughs. The swallow weeps and sews away forever. She casts a gay coverlet over the sewing machine, thereby transforming it from a nickel-and-steel creature of toil into a hillock of red and blue silk flowers. She does not want to be reminded now of the day. In her light, soft dress, she nestles down in my arms. She chatters. She whispers and murmurs and sings. So slender and pale, half-starved she is, too. And so light that one can easily carry her to the bed, the iron camp bed. Such a sweet air of surrender as she clings about one's neck. She sighs and she smiles, a child with closed eyes, sighs and trembles and stammers a little bit. She breathes deep and she utters small cries.
I look at her. I look again and again. I, too, would be so. Silently, I ask, is this it? Is this it? And the swallow names me with all kinds of fair names, and is embarrassed and tender and nestles close to me. And as I leave her, I ask, are you happy, little swallow? Then she kisses me many times and makes faces and waves and nods and nods. But I go down the stairs and am full of wonder. She is happy. How easily. I cannot understand. For is she not still another being, a life unto herself wherein I can never come? Would she not still be so, though I came with all the fires of love? Ugh, love. It is a torch falling into an abyss, revealing nothing but only how deep it is. I set off down the street to the station. This is not it. No, this is not it either. One is only more alone there than ever.